No rack can torture me, my soul at liberty. Behind this mortal bone, there knits a bolder one. You cannot prick with saw, nor pierce with scimitar. Two bodies therefore be, bind one, the other fly. The eagle of his nest, no easier divest, and gain the sky than mayest thou. Except thyself may be thine enemy. Captivity is consciousness, soul's liberty.
This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brianne Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us,
and what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Dickinson's coming of age.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
What's up, Jericho?
We are back again to talk about Dickinson, the show, and about Emily Dickinson's poetry and the America she lived in, an America where slavery and slave catching were everyday realities.
Lord. And to help us deal with all of that, we have our special guest, poet and playwright, Malcolm Tariq.
Along with our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray, who will bring her knowledge of Emily Dickinson's life and world to the conversation.
So let's recap. Dickinson, Season 1, Episode 5, I Am Afraid to Own a Body.
This may be our most fucked up synopsis yet. A fugitive slave roundup is happening in Amherst. Emily's father, Edward, supports the Fugitive Slave Act, as does Emily's suitor, George Gould. Emily wants George to tell his relatives in the South that slavery is an abomination. He says a conversation like that would ruin Thanksgiving dinner.
Later, George asks to speak with Emily's father in private and asks for Emily's hand in marriage. Her father responds by saying he worries about how lenient George is with Emily.
Henry, the Dickinson's black hired hand, shows up. Maggie, the Irish immigrant maid, asks Henry to go to the blacksmith. Emily explains to Maggie that he doesn't want to do that because he's afraid he'll be abducted.
As Emily prepares to act out Othello with her Shakespeare club, she tries to get Henry to take on the title role. He refuses politely, while George takes the opportunity to put Emily in her place, telling her someone like Henry has no place in their club.
Emily's offended, as much by George telling her what to do as anything else, and says to Henry, "Life shouldn't be like this." Henry responds to Emily that her life is easy.
Though George later tries to explain his actions, Emily is angry and refuses to marry him.
In the meantime, Sue is working as a governess in Boston. Her boss comes into her bedroom and locks the door behind him. Hey, Breezy, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm ready to talk about this show that starts with Emily and her father playing a game of old maid. And we hear the father say he'd rather be a spinster than a wife.
Yeah, sure. Of course he'd rather be a spinster than a wife. Right. As he makes use of his wife.
Right. He'd rather be a spinster with a wife is probably more accurate, which who wouldn't want to? I definitely am trying to be a spinster with a wife. Yeah. And then, you know, we see George Gould show up and, you know, this question of the Fugitive Slave Act is brought up and sort of what's the family's responsibility to the South, whether or not they will indeed help catch this person. Or as the law requires, or whether or not they're gonna ignore it. We get some Othello in this episode with all of the teens performing Shakespeare. It's a lot.
It's really interesting that we're recording this episode about the ownership and control of other people's bodies.
Yes.
In the wake of the end of Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me that the arguments that this show is trying to bring up, the arguments that were going on in the middle of the 1800s are clearly still the arguments we're still having,
right?
You know, about whether or not it's okay to tell people what to do with their lives and how to manage their own bodies. And this show has the opportunity to do that through a conversation about slavery and the Fugitive Slave Act. I have to say, Breezy, you know, difficult for me to talk about because it's just horrific.
It is. And I feel like they could have done an episode that was just dealing with that issue mm-hmm. of the Fugitive Slave Act and that issue of, mm-hmm. of enslavement in this country's history. And yet they choose to also include this issue of sexual assault when it comes to Sue being mm-hmm. working as a governess in mm-hmm. the family home. And so that phrase, I'm afraid to own a body, that body is working in all of these different ways, you know, mm-hmm. I'm afraid to own an enslaved person. I'm afraid to be a person with a body in this mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid to be a woman with a body in this world. And I don't know, it raises a lot of questions sort of like about sort of who we see as vulnerable in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of one thing that strikes me about it is in both of these questions, sort of this issue of being sexual assaulted for Sue, this issue of the Fugitive Slave Act with Henry, there's just this sort of erasure of Black women's experience mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that happens as, mm-hmm. as a result, because Black women own a body that is both vulnerable in both of these ways.
Maybe now is a good time for us to introduce our very special guest who's with yes. us today, whose work I'm very excited about, and that is the one and only poet and playwright, Malcolm Tariq. Malcolm is the author of Heed the Hollow, winner of the Cave Canem Poetry Prize and the Georgia Author of the Year Award.
Malcolm is now Senior Manager of Editorial Projects for Prison and Justice Writing at PEN America. Malcolm, thank you so much for being our guest here.
Yeah, and let me say this. Malcolm grew up in Savannah and he went to Emory, where I teach as an undergrad. So, hey. You know, big ups to the South. And I think it's really great to have him talk with us today about this show that talks about the South in the middle mm-hmm. of the 19th century. How you doing, Malcolm? Welcome.
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. How are you all?
We're very happy to have you here.
Yes, we are. Speaking of the South and this question of sort of this episode, sort of the relation of the North and South and that Fugitive Slave Act, what were you guys thinking about when George was like, oh, I can't bringing this up to my family or my Southern family about sort of slavery and the act mm-hmm. that would make for a terrible Thanksgiving dinner mm-hmm. conversation. Mm-hmm. I know, Jericho, you said this episode sort of resonates with a lot of what's happening in today's day and age. And that question mm-hmm. of like, oh, polite family conversation over the Thanksgiving dinner is definitely mm-hmm. something that we have been dealing with. I don't know. What do you make of this? Are you urging your white friends to... to fight they family?
I was going to say, do I have white friends? I do. But I think, like, I ask myself that question sometimes because I think that I'm friends with white people who, like, I don't have to, they already know what they're supposed to be doing. Mm. And so, like, I don't really have to do much.
I don't find myself urging white people to do things. But can I tell you this? I mean, I've probably said this on the show before. One of my biggest and best and most talented mentors, Natasha Trethewey. One of the things that I've seen her do when things about race come up, when white people are around, is she'll just start asking questions. Mm. And I think in that way, she means to urge them to see mm. things differently. Mm. Maybe there are times in my life, having seen that example, that I try to emulate it, you know? Mm-hmm. But I find that in reality, my expectations are actually low. My expectations are low, not just because of something I think about white people, but because I too, as a Black person, come from a family full of crazy folk mm. who say stupid stuff all the time. Do you know what I mean? Yes. That yeah. I have to listen to if I go home. And in order for me to be able to get through the holiday or the weekend, it's really a matter of picking and choosing what I am or am not going to say something about. So I don't know that I have this expectation that, I mean, it would be nice, you know, but I don't know that I have this expectation that white people, in order to interact with their families, are talking to their families. I mean, I actually more think that white people are doing a lot of what I'm doing, and you're sort of like thinking about the potential of what you can do when you're away from your family in order to get over, get past, and move the rest of the world past what your family believes in. So what force are you going to bring, you know, as a person in your family that is doing the absolute opposite of that thing? And then sometimes that thing is racism, but sometimes it's sexism. Sometimes it's homophobia. It's always whatever it is. It's crazy. And you're supposed to deal with it like it's okay. Like, how do you, in the rest of your life, make it so it's clear that that's not okay?
That makes sense to me. Because as Lord knows, my family do be saying some stuff that's wild, and I don't always have every moment to fight them, but I'd be trying to have something smart to say, at least, you know, like I need my white friends that when your family is wild, and like at the bare minimum, I need you to have something smart to say.
Well, okay. I think I'm going to change my answer from earlier, because I just remembered something. Yes. So I have this friend from middle school that, and I'm 32 right now, and I haven't seen him. I didn't see him from like 2004 to like 2019. And so he came to New York visiting, and this is a white man from Savannah, Georgia. And our middle school was most, I believe he was the only white kid that was in the regular classes with us. All the white kids were in the magnet program. So he was like surrounded by black people. And then, so he comes to New York and he's showing me something on his phone. And, oh, I think it's, he automated something on his phone to say the N-word and was like laughing about it. We were having like such a good time catching up that I was like, okay, I'm gonna return to this later. I'm gonna like bookmark it. And so later that day or the next day, I said something via text, like maybe you shouldn't say that word. And he responded very quickly and very positively to that. And we were able to like, kind of like laugh about it now, like as a, oh, remember that time I said that thing because I didn't know. And it was because his black friends were allowing him to say that stuff around them. Mm-hmm. And so, I had to be like, no, don't do that, like in the world. And that is an example of someone who like a white person who I understood their background. And it's like, oh, I know you don't mean that thing. And so this is something that I can stop for our friendship to last. Had he not responded positively, like I wouldn't have met up with him this weekend when he's in town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Emily said something in the show, right? Emily tried to stick up for Henry in all of the different moments. Like when Maggie was trying to send him to town, she was the one spoke up and said, oh, he can't because of the fugitive. She also though invites him to read the part of Othello and sort of brings him into this awkward position. I don't know. I think it's sort of the other thing that can go wrong with having white friends is sort of that well-meaning white person who has your back, but is maybe like doing too much, you know, or like doesn't quite understand the nuances of who you are and like what that means in a certain space.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I just say about that moment, that scene I thought was so good at capturing the levels at which white people sort of understand what is going on in a racially motivated moment, right? The maid, I think her name's Maggie, right? Am I right about that? Yeah. She is absolutely even unaware of the problem. Has no idea. For as small as Amherst is, for the fact that you know, she works with Henry, for the fact that according to Aoife, she probably lives right next to a bunch of black people, right? She has no idea that people are out hunting a slave, an escaped slave, who they think is in Massachusetts, in Amherst in particular. No clue of what's going, like, no idea, completely out of it.
Yeah.
Emily thinks, oh, the way to fix this problem, the way to handle something that you're in the midst of fear, right? So my job while you're in the midst of fear is to give you something to do. I should put you to work. I should show you how concerned I am
by creating a project for you. And you'll enjoy that project because you get to do it with white people. Right. That'll take your mind off of everything that's going on out there in Amherst with these slave catchers, who, by the way, and I want to bring Aoife in 27 seconds, because it's a real thing to be a supposed free Black person in the middle of a time where slave catchers are looking for a fugitive slave, because they are willing to bring anybody back below the Mason-Dixon line, right? But then Austin, Emily's brother, does an interesting thing. He says, I'll go to the blacksmith. Right. If somebody needs to go to the blacksmith and that's your job, and if you go to the blacksmith, you could get kidnapped. Maybe, since I'm not doing anything here, I'll go to the blacksmith. Right. Before that, all of the conversation is not about people. It's about laws and the government. Right. Before we get to this moment, Maggie, and we see these sort of three levels of white response for that time and maybe also for this time. Right. Before that, nothing is about the fact that somebody who had to go through the trouble of getting from the South to Amherst, Massachusetts, is now being hunted down. But we should ask Aoife about some of these things, our rogue scholar. Will you come into us, Aoife?
That moment made me crazy. Made me crazy. Let me tell you something. If you were escaping and you made it to Massachusetts, you would never go through Amherst. Let me just say that. You would not go through Amherst. Amherst was not a good place. That was not where the Underground Railroad went. The Underground Railroad went 10 miles to the west on the west side of the Connecticut River, but Amherst was not a good place. So let me just say that a lot of times when I'm thinking about this show, I'm thinking about what Ralph Ellison said about there being two different kinds of history. There's the written history that's kind of stylized and like ancient myth, he said. And then there's the unwritten history, which is sort of hidden from us because, I mean, we might lose hope, right? About the differences, right? The disparities. So this unwritten history still operates, right? It's still affects us, and it's full of life, like real life. It is real life. So a lot of times when I'm thinking about the show, I'm thinking about how they've opened up that space so that we can know the unwritten history, which I think they did in episode 4. They come to episode 5 and it's like, what were the writers thinking? I mean, first of all, the Dickinsons had relatives in the South. The Dickinsons were sympathetic to their Southern relatives. What were they doing? Were they trying to create this generational thing so that Emily kind of wink, wink, oh yeah, I know Henry shouldn't go into town. I'm with him, Austin. I mean, that whole thing. And that Maggie doesn't know. I mean, Maggie's brothers probably socialized with Henry in the same taverns. So here was that moment where the class thing gets all confused. The generational thing gets all confused. And they use this working class figure, or this poor figure, white figure, to move that story along when she would have known all of that. So, I mean, let's just talk about the real thing of what happened. Emily would have been clueless. 2 years after the Fugitive Slave Act passes, Wells Newport, from an old Black family in Amherst, I mean, their descendants still live in Amherst, but Wells Newport in 1852, Emily Dickinson writes, so he's working as a stable hand for the family. And she says, Wells disappeared. Why did Wells disappear? It's 1852. Nothing about what happened to him. And my suspicion, if I was a thinking person, is he pissed some white guy off and he had to go to a safe place for a while until feeling, because he could get sold. If anything, it's not a generational thing around where you stood on the fugitive slave, but more a class or where you stood economically in the world. So all that nuance, all of that unwritten history, right, as it were, gets lost in that scene. And
you know, the show it wants to make a lot of impossible things happen in order to make a point, right? There's a point in the show where they're playing Othello. Emily and her friends from school, maybe not from school, but her friends in the town. George Gould is there, Austin's there. And one of their friends who they get to play Othello, at first at least, the young man who is an Asian American man who's interacting with these white people in ways that we understand was probably not the case. Just as when we see Native people, Indigenous people, in this show, the ways in which they show them, I wonder often, you know, is that the case, you know? But what's interesting to me about this is while the show wants to be diverse and inclusive, it cannot, and no show ever can, change the position of Black people in history. Mm. So you can sort of like make these, and I notice TV shows do this all the time when it comes to people of Asian descent and Indigenous people. They just start making stuff up, you know what I mean, in terms of what is possible, but you don't end up making stuff up in terms of what's possible for Black people. Do you know what I mean? And so what's interesting to me about the show is while they can sort of twist what is possible for Maggie or who Maggie would have really been, and twist what is possible for Emily, twist what is possible for the Asian Othello. You know, they twist these things for the point of the show. And yet when it comes to Henry, when it comes to the Black man in the show, he plays the part as the part would have been, right? A Black man afraid because of the Fugitive Slave Act, which is really interesting and a very interesting comment culturally about how Blackness can work in media, that Black does not get to erase itself or its history at its appearance, you know? Breezy?
No, I was going to say that there's no way it could, though, in this type of story. Blackness and enslavement is sort of, or enslavement is like America's original sin. And so to have this story set in an American past, they have to reckon with the realities of Blackness and the realities of the limitations put on people by Blackness. The thing that bothered me about that Othello scene, or that was just like, I don't know, just like a tired trope, Henry's big moment, or is when he reads Othello's monologue, and you know, the music gets all dramatic and we're all staring at him, and the feeling that I get, you know, is just like, oh look, you know, the Negro can read, you know, instead of like that's the important, that's like the thing that redeems his character or makes his character worth this amount of existential angst. Yeah, I don't know, there's just so many choices that the show made in this episode that I'm just like, why?
Yeah. Why? Why? And so we started talking. I was like, oh, there were other races in there, but I just assumed in my mind that those other people were supposed to be white, but they were like trying to make it like the casting more inclusive. And so when I saw Henry, I remember, I looked down for something and then he comes on the screen and I look up and I was like, oh, there's Black people now? But there weren't Black people, there was a Black person. And when I saw him, I also thought that he would be like a character like in the background or a character, like a minor character, like in this episode. Mm-hmm. But really the episode comes to be structured around him. Mm-hmm. And then that Othello scene, I was like, oh, this is all of that for this. Like it wasn't like anything more. I expected just something more like nuanced or like challenging for both the characters and for the viewers.
I think one of the hardest things in the world to do is play people who are or who were enslaved. I mean, I just cannot imagine their psychology or their psychological damage. And so I think it's very, very interesting when people have to do that. I also think it's weird whenever I'm watching anything. You know, I watched Harriet on the plane the other day, because that's what was on the plane. And, you know, and I didn't love Harriet, but I will say this. I felt again that thing that I always feel whenever I watch movies about enslaved Black people, and that is, this is not even it. There is no depiction. You know, what I love, people hated that movie, Beloved, made from the Toni Morrison novel with Danny Glover and Oprah Winfrey. But what I loved about Beloved is that all the Black people had awful teeth. I loved that about Beloved. I was like, now that's closer to it. Do you know what I mean? I still didn't get it. Do you know what I'm saying? But it's still, it was closer to what things might have actually been like. Nobody wants to see the movie that really shows us what slavery must have been like, or really being Black in that moment must have been like. Henry's played by an actor, Shanaza Uche, has the task of telling Emily Dickinson that her life is easy. And I love this moment where he calls her by her first and last name. And he has to figure out, how do I do this where I am letting this white girl have it, but also not doing it in a way so offensive that I would be in greater trouble, or that's so impossible to see. And I think he manages it. We skip George Gould's intentions when he first arrives at Emily's house. George Gould is actually there to talk to her father. He wants to talk to him about asking for Emily's hand in marriage, but he's not asking Emily to talk to her father. Although she's already told him, like what, 6 episodes now? She's 4 episodes. I am not interested, George. I don't want to marry you. And so he's ultimately, you know, in this show that is about the possession of other people's bodies, he thinks he's going to make a deal for Emily's body behind her back through her father, which is where you would buy a woman's body, right? Yeah. Her father, who has already said, I think it's better to be a spinster than a married woman. I would love to hear anything that y'all thought about that.
It feels almost out of character for him to have gone and asked the father, because he seems, I guess it just shows how desperate he was, you know, and like just unwilling to listen to Emily at all, because she has been saying no, I don't want to marry you this whole time. I mean, and it, in some ways it sort of shows the ways that like George is inevitably being indoctrinated into like what it means to be a man in this time period, because he tries winning Emily over human to human, and when that doesn't work, he says, well, I'm a man and I should just go ask another man about this. It feels like, I don't know, it feels like a really big, a moment of betrayal, and also a moment of deep sort of just like, just indoctrination into what it means to be a man at the time.
It's so sad like too. Yeah, Malcolm.
It felt like kind of like what you're saying, Breezy, like a violence when that scene was happening, because he knew that Emily would not like that. And so to me, I was like, what is he doing? Is this how he wants to live his life now? And so that's the moment where I started to, I wasn't totally on his side, because I'm like, she already told you no, like 1 to 2 times, like that's enough. Like we don't need to see you like try to pursue her to death. And so when we got to that scene, I was like, okay, now you are harassing this person. Even if it's not an intentional or like very pointed thing, it is an action that just says a lot about how he chose not to listen to her or even respect her decision.
He's just letting me down. Y'all know I used to have a crush on George Gould. Then we get to this episode and my crush is no more. George is like the guy that's telling Emily over and over again, we can do this and we can do it without it being as traditional. And this episode, because of a conversation he has with Emily's father, it's almost like the father who's trying to poison his intention. He's like, he totally gives George a kind of advice that is like the worst advice for winning over Emily Dickinson in the show, at least, right? And so George is doing thing after thing. You know, when Austin wants to play Desdemona, George is upset about that. When Emily wants to involve Henry in the play, George is the one who stops Henry's monologue and his interaction in the play. And so George is suddenly doing all these things because they're not fit. You know, they're not, I don't think your father would like this. He's like, oh, one way to have Emily is to become her father, right? And so he thinks the answer is to become a facsimile of Emily Dickinson's father, which is a damn shame, because he's the creepiest man on television.
Up until this point, he's been trying to do things to liberate Emily or to make her happy. And it's just like a real change to sort of like, no, I have to be the one to take care of your morals and take care of you in a way that's really invalidating.
I saw that for Austin, actually. And so in this episode where Austin was doing things, it was like, to me in this episode, my perception of them like switched, because I thought Austin, how the series started, that Austin would become like the cookie cutter of his dad. And as I was watching this show, I was like, oh, Austin wants that role. Like, that's interesting. And like, he's like, he stood up for Henry by like doing that chore or thing that he had to do. And I was just very surprised by Austin at the same time that I was surprised that George was also going through this like transformation, or just like we were learning new, or I was learning new things about the both of them and about how complicated they both are. Because up until that point, just because they're white men, like I just had like, you're either good or bad. And I mean, that's still the case actually, but there's more, I saw more from them. That space between good and bad, like, oh, you're good or bad right now, and you can be good or like a different thing later.
If you measured the breadth of Emily Dickinson's world by where she spent her time or how far she traveled, it's a very small world.
But her imagination, her language, her sense of the human heart went far beyond the part of Western Massachusetts where she lived and wrote. And through her poems, she traveled across time to attract readers and inspire art and conversation from the 19th century to the 21st.
Located in the same part of the world where Dickinson lived and wrote, Smith College is a place whose influence is much larger than its enrollment. Its community of students, faculty, and alums is full of the bold voices and quiet commitment that drive change.
We thank Smith for sponsoring The Slave Is Gone. Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu. When Dickinson writes the poem that is the title for this episode, or when Dickinson writes the poems that she's writing during the Civil War, how much do we know about what Emily Dickinson thought about Black people and about slavery in particular? And then how is that at all different from what her family would have thought, Aoife?
It's a really good question, because it's how do we know? And I've thought a lot about that poem that we use for the podcast, because I wondered, can something be accidentally liberatory? And yet, over time, Dickinson does, you know, over the span of her life and over the span of her writings, and we have the poems, we also have letters that she sent to other people, not all of the letters, but she does exhibit an understanding over time. She was like incredibly bigoted as a young person, said horrible things about Irish immigrants, and her brother was a bigot. So the gentle Austin that we see in the show is not the real, in terms of his attitudes around race and class, not worth repeating because it's hurtful. It's hurtful. The disappointment is at the end of her life in the 1880s, when there was a big backlash about abolitionism in the 1880s. Emily Dickinson uses terms in her letters and is sort of fearful of this Black man who is now working for the family. They've had sort of a period from the mid-1850s, I think, a lot of Irish immigrants replacing Black laboring people. So a Black man is working there again in the 1880s, mid-1880s, and she says insulting things about this man, but puts it in the mouth of her nephew. So, you know, you can kind of get away with it. Oh, I'm just quoting. She's mimicking her time, or not mimicking her time, but I mean, there was a backlash in the 1880s. There's this put down of abolitionism, and there's this quickening of this anti-immigrant, anti-Black attitudes among white people that sort of occurs in the 1880s. And she mouths it.
I think it's interesting that the show, while they're willing to show Emily sort of misstep with issues of like class, or just sort of her willing to show her like wanting a maid and not wanting to do the work herself, they're willing to show her be a well-meaning white woman who makes, but maybe makes this like little mistakes with Henry. But of course she can't be an out and out racist in the show, you know, like she can't be
she can't be who she was in the show because we wouldn't watch it.
Yeah, we wouldn't.
I wouldn't watch it.
Right.
It
wouldn't exactly. Be palatable. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it makes the free Black men in Amherst look powerless when indeed the free Black men in Amherst were arming themselves secretly. They were arming themselves when the fugitive slave. And I just want to say, 10 miles down the road, Sojourner Truth is living. She's living in Northampton. Sojourner Truth is living 10 miles away during the Fugitive Slave Act. You think that Black men were coming to the Dickinsons to be protected? No, they were protecting themselves.
I want to talk about Sue and her arc in this, her small arc in this episode, where we see her essentially sort of this show suggesting that she was sexually assaulted by the man who hired her to take care of his kids. I wondered, watching that, once I got over the fact that they put that detail in this particular episode, because I feel like they should have done it someplace else, what was the period sort of response to sexual assault? You know, like, were those cases being brought to court? Is there someone that Sue could tell to sort of get justice for what happened to her? Or was it more something that women just sort of kept to themselves and sort of buried?
Boys will be boys, right? It's tolerated, yeah. Tolerated because, and it's so class-based, right? If you are a poor person, you're a rapist. If you're a middle-class or upper-class person, like the James, whoever her employer is, you're a rake. And boys will be boys, and they just, you know, they're taking their right. And that's person who's working as the nanny or the servant is white, right? If she's enslaved, it's the norm and there's an economic benefit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the case with Sue, there was a really, really famous case that the suffragists brought up at that time, a woman by the name of Hester Vaughn. So I think that the writers are thinking about this Hester Vaughn case. She gets raped by her employer. She becomes pregnant. He fires her for becoming pregnant. Mm. The child ends up dying. I mean, she's impoverished. People who are working as in domestic kinds of work are working on the edges of despair and destitution. So the child dies, and then she's thrown into jail for killing her child. Well, the child died because they were both poor and the child's more vulnerable. I mean, the numbers of babies who die from poverty is enormous in this time. And so this becomes a huge, huge case that the suffragists take up. And so I think that's what they're pointing to. But you're right. I mean, there's just like too many things going on in this episode.
It's interesting that you said earlier that for the case of sexual assault, when it came to Black enslaved women, that it was sort of like an economic, there was economic incentive for rape, which is wild, but you know, yeah, right. That's the way slavery works. And then the show sort of erases that in their framing of the episode. They're essentially having another one of those who's got it worse discussions. Is it sort of Black people or is it women? And then of course, anytime you pit Black woes against women woes, you're automatically erasing the woes of Black women who are experiencing sexual assault as they're experiencing all of the evils of slavery. I don't know. I feel like it was just a really poor choice in terms of like the writing of this episode. You know, like, I don't know. I thought their take on that question with Emily's sort of willingness to help, but also sort of her blind spots being exposed. I thought that was well done, but including Sue's narrative in the story is just, and it's also sort of disrespectful to that narrative. We only get like little snippets of it. So they don't even really take the time to really engage with how vulnerable Sue really is in this household.
It might be our opportunity to think about the fact that consent, there was no such thing as consent during that time. Yeah. So rape and marriage, that was part of the deal. And so they start to show you that right? Because he touches her, or, oh, call me James. So he begins to
cross that boundary.
Yeah, exactly.
And in that scene, I remember thinking this could be like one of two things, but like it could be both. So I, because of Sue, her like love life and who she chooses to be intimate with, a lot of that is determined by capitalism and her not having money to like be a self-sustaining person. And so when that scene happened with her employer and the signals that were like, he was sending signals that he expected her to read. And it was very calculated to a point. And I was like, oh, this man is about to do some math in his head so he could try to like get her under his will. And I mean, sexual assault a lot of times is about power. And so he was definitely asserting his power because he knew that she was vulnerable in like several, she has no family, she has no money, she's engaged to Austin. And even then you're like, are they really engaged? Because I thought that they had told everybody, but then we learn, with Sue, like she just has no options.
Yeah, I feel like everyone else by comparison is living in a fantasy land, you know, where everything's gonna work out. And Sue's just like our dose of bitter reality.
That's exactly what it feels like,
Malcolm, can you read a poem for us?
So do you want me to read the Othello poem? And so this poem, The Mother of Othello, comes before us. I was wondering, Othello talks a lot about his mother. I think like that's where he gets his color from, basically, his mom. And he talks about his mom's relationship with the father and then to him, but the mother like never speaks for herself because she's dead. And so I wrote a poem, I wrote a sonnet that's in her voice because I wanted to know how she actually felt about her son being this like man of color in this white world and like having to leave his family, I guess, to become like successful. And what I did was I underlined every time I saw the word like more or specific phrases in the play. And so this is a play made out of those lines and I like kind of play with them. And these are all things that he says, except for the last line. I'll tell you who says that if you don't know. The mother of Othello comes before us. Men raced into darkness, look for light. They return black as my face. My name that is as flesh made him all the more an example he could not return. Had he devoured my discourse, observed my title, I would not be the monster in his thought. My mystery is the cause. And when I turn the business of my soul, it was I who killed her. Had I taught him to tell my story, would it repair him? Certain, men should be what they seem, but doubt was my first gift, then fate. I must confess the vices of my blood. I love my son. I hate the more. And so the last line, I hate the more, is from Iago, the antagonist. I am a playwright. I know these words. The antagonist in the fight.
I love that. I love that you use lines from Othello, lines from his mouth.
I was very curious about like his relationship, like his the true relationship to his mother and like what she thought. And then, you know, with the murder at the end, it was, I just had a lot of questions for this man and his mom.
Well, it's been wonderful having you on the show, Malcolm. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This is fun.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Slave is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
That's Brianne Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee, and they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Caveh Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament.
Thanks as always to our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray, author of Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language.
Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers. Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky is the audio engineer and editor. Marissa Budlong is our research assistant. Our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Our advisors are Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk. And the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutelle Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us to get updates about upcoming guests and for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art and the world she lived in.